Good afternoon. I didn't want to start without Senator Brown.
Yeah.
Today we're honored to have the House civil judiciary here, other than the uncivil.
Civil,
that's true. And last time we met, we had a public hearing on Senate Bill 408. Today we have that same bill before us. And Mr. Taylor, why don't you touch on the two amendments?
Chair, members of the committee, we have a -6 and -7 amendments before us. I think Beth that maybe we should bring up for Pedro Anderson and FCS and Nancy Millis and the court. The -6 amendments are amendments that we wrote on, I think, in the last 6 weeks. They're basically consensus amendments. The -7 amendments are still a major policy issue. The -7 amendments would put in the statute provisions relating to termination of parental rights against the child who's been in foster care 15 in the last 22 months. The FCS is proposing that they do some regulations. And that's all you find. The courts are suggesting, Anthony Miller is suggesting that the statute is enabled to tell you what it says. The name of this bill is a requirement, or I should say a requirement, that strongly suggested by the federal government and the family, the adoption of the state free act. And one number I heard was on the biennium or something, I had to cover a small number of questions. So they can address the issues probably better than I can in relation to the policy issues still out there. And can go through maybe briefly go over the bill and
Kay, and Nancy, why don't you come forward then? In committee, this is one, too, where we're still waiting for the federal government to draft the regulations. So we're shooting in the dark a little bit here. But,
Were you short?
Pardon?
Were you short?
Why don't we begin? And as I understand, the -6 amendments, everyone's in agreement, correct?
Yes.
The -7 is where we still have a decision to make. So why don't we, if you wouldn't mind, just touch on the substantive issues on the -6 rather than going over it line by line, and then we'll go right to the -7.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Kay Tran, Administrator of the State Office for Services to Children and Families. I'm here today to support Senate Bill 408-6 amendments. I have with me Linda Goss from the Department of Justice, who will walk you through the amendments that are in -6.
Okay. Good afternoon, Senator Bryant, members of the committee. My name is Linda Guss. I'm an Assistant Attorney General with the Human Services Section of the General Counsel Division of the Oregon Department of Justice, and I'm here at the request of FCF to just talk about the amendments that are before the committee today. Now, I will just go through them very quickly. We have
a hard time hearing.
I'm sorry.
I don't know if it's the sound system or.
Not on. Oh, he's working. He's still working.
Excuse me.
Can you talk just a little louder?
Okay, I certainly will. Let me know if you can't hear me. There should be a hand engrossed version that I prepared that should reflect the -6 amendments. And just going quickly through some of the highlights. On page 3, section 5, the deletion of lines 40 through 44 is merely a deletion to correct a redundancy. The added language on lines 35 and 36 implements the provisions of the AFSA that allow the state agency to use the parent locate service from the Support Enforcement Division. On page 4, lines 17 through 19, we've deleted a definition that was added, but that essential definition will appear later in the language of the bill. On page 5, there are a couple of additional definitions, a definition of permanent foster care, which AFSA specifically authorizes a court to consent to so that the child has a permanent foster care placement, and then also planned permanent living arrangement is another term that's used in the Adoption and Safe Families Act and needed defining. On page 7, lines 27 through 31 are also amended. The Adoption and Safe Families Act requires that foster parents, pre-adoptive parents, or relatives that are providing care for children be given notice of all hearings regarding children and be given an opportunity to be heard. the ability to get notice and be heard, however, does not make those persons parties to those proceedings. And the amendments that are reflected in the hand-engrossed version reflect suggestions not only from committee counsel, but also clarification of who has the responsibility to give notice to the caretaker, and clarifies that the persons are not parties to those proceedings. On page 9, section what will now be section 11, lines 34 and 35, will be amended to reflect that if a court determines that one of several circumstances is present, that the juvenile court may make a finding that the state agency is not required to make reasonable efforts to reintegrate a child into a parent's home. And this is directly out of AFSCME. The definition of aggravated circumstances you'll see in the bill is left by the Adoption and Safe Families Act for the states to define. The next substantive amendment appears on page 11 at the top, beginning on line 5. This amendment is intended to retain the general process that was set up in Senate Bill 689, the Best Interest of the Child Bill, last session. And so this section, which amends 419B350, provides that all reviews conducted by the Citizen Review Board or hearings conducted in lieu of those CRB reviews will look like the review that Senate Bill 689 established last session. And it also provides that if certain findings are made that the time within which a parent has to regain custody of their child can be extended. That amendment is found on lines 35, 36, and 37. In that same provision, in section 16, you'll see that there are a number of deletions, and those deletions actually have been moved to section 15. So that second piece of the Senate Bill 689 process has not been deleted. It's simply been moved to another section by this bill. The next substantive amendment would appear on page 12 in section what will now be 14, and it simply clarifies when a permanency hearing will be held. And a permanency hearing is the new word, a new name for the 18-month dispositional review hearing, which has been in federal statute for many years and in state statute. This will also take the place of the Senate Bill 689 second review hearing. So we've attempted to meld all of those together, and that's what's reflected in Section 14, and the amendments simply clarify when those hearings will occur. The last substantive amendments that I'll talk about are actually additions at the end of the bill. And in the hand-engrossed bill, I've actually included all of those on pages 17, 18, 19, 20, and 21. First, section 21 adds to Senate Bill 408 the Adoption and Safe Families Act language, which requires the state agency to file a termination of parental rights petition in three different circumstances, and then also lays out three exceptions to that mandate. So in Section 21, you'll see that Subsection 1 provides a mandate for SDF to file in three instances, and then Section 2 reflects the circumstances which are included in the Adoption and Safe Families Act where the state is not required to file. Sections 22, 23, 24, and 25 include provisions that the Best Interest of the Children Committee agreed needed to be clarified or corrected from the last bill, and so those are essentially housekeeping provisions that were agreed should be included in this legislation. I'd be happy to answer any questions that you might have. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions on the Dash 6 amendments? Yes, Judy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And actually, you might have said why, but I was having a hard time keeping up with you. But why did you exclude, and I can't, it was one of the first pages of the, you deleted on page 6 the Citizen Review Board portion, and I'm just curious about why you did that.
Representative Uberlau, the bill as originally drafted included that section in an effort to create a timeline for CRB reviews and the Senate Bill 689 reviews and the permanency hearing that would all start from a single point in time. But as SCF and the Judicial Department began talking about the legislation, they came to another agreement about how those different reviews should be timed, and so this deletion reflects the agreement that SCF and the Judicial Department reached.
Thank you.
Uh-huh. Other questions? All right, why don't we go to the Dash 7?
Mr. Chair, Joint Chairs, members of both committees, good afternoon. For the record, my name is Nancy Miller. I'm the Citizen Review Board Director here on behalf of the Oregon Judicial Department today. We'd like to thank SCF for all the work that's gone into this bill. It's been a very long time coming to consensus, and we are very, very close here. The Dash 7 amendments were introduced at the request of the Judicial Department. They look very similar to the Dash 6s, except on page 2 of the Dash 7. Line 7, line 6 through 10. We believe this is a significant public policy decision that the legislature needs to reach, and would like to ask if it's okay with the Chair, Judge Steve Harrell from Portland, and Timothy Travis to come up and briefly explain them to the committee.
That would be fine. And committee, if you want to look for comparable language, it would be on page 5 of the Dash 6, lines 4 through 10.
17 of the Dash 6?
Oh, you're looking at the Hannon Grove.
I'm not the Hannon Grove. I was looking at the actual.
Oh, you're looking at the actual. Yeah. Oh, okay, because they're on 17 on the
17 on the Hannon Grove.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Timothy Travis. I'm the program manager of the Juvenile Court Improvement Project with the State Court Administrator's Office. I have had distributed to you my testimony, which in an uncharacteristic way is short and sweet. In a characteristic way, it contains an error. If you will look at the second paragraph on the first page, it says this deals with Section 24. That should say Section 21 of the Dash 6 amendments. The purpose of the Dash 7 amendments is to put into the statute a definition of compelling reasons. These compelling reasons comprise an exception to the federally mandated rule that when a child has been in foster care for 15 of the last 22 months, the state must either file a petition to terminate parental rights, or if a petition has already been filed by another party in the case, the state must join that petition. There are three exceptions to this you must terminate rule, and one of them is that compelling reasons exist why it's not in the best interest of the child to terminate. We believe that these exceptions, these compelling reasons, should be spelled out in the statute for two reasons. First, let me say that the agency's position is that they should define these in their administrative rules rather than have them in the statute. The first reason that we believe that they should be in the statute is because the legislature, in our opinion, and not the agency, should be making this policy. This is very important stuff for families. It has to do with termination of parental rights. You're dealing with people's 14th Amendment constitutional liberty interest in consanguinity in their family. We believe what constitutes an exception to this is a public policy decision that should be made by the legislature and not by a state agency. The second reason that we believe that this should be in the statute is that this is a rule that is so important for families that have children in foster care that this rule and its exceptions ought to be out front in the statute where they are accessible to and understandable by all of the parties to the case. Those of us who have practiced juvenile law know that the administrative rules are, for the run-of-the-mill, a quite esoteric document. In fact, there are very few juvenile firms in the state that could produce an up-to-date copy of the Oregon Administrative Rules. To find it would require a trip to the courthouse, to the law library for the county, and even then, it's even money as to whether or not you will find the administrative rules. We recently did, within the last few years, an update of the juvenile code, and one of the rules that we followed in doing that update was to put things into the juvenile code in such a way that they would be accessible to and understandable by the lawyers who deal with these cases on a part-time basis, as well as citizens who might pick up the statute book. If we put these exceptions, these definitions of these exceptions, in the administrative rules instead of in the statute, then we're taking a step back from this accessibility and we're taking a step towards esoterica. So that is my testimony about this particular piece of the bill. If you have any questions, I'd be pleased to respond. Otherwise, Judge Harrell can...
Why don't we hear from Judge Harrell first, then we'll open up for questions.
For the record, good afternoon, Senator Bryan, members of both committees. For the record, I'm Stephen Harrell. I'm a family court judge in Multnomah County. Let me just add on to what Tim said, something that I think is, at least to my way of thinking, even more critical that this amendment be adopted. SCF's position, with all due respect, is that that what constitutes compelling reasons ought to be a matter of their own internal rulemaking. And that doesn't work in court. And the reason it doesn't work in court is the court, as you'll notice, in the Dash 6 amendments and the language that just precedes what we're talking about, the court has a duty to review what the agency does and what the compelling reasons are. And to bury them in their own internal regulations, for one thing, isn't binding on the court at all. I have a duty to determine whether compelling reasons exist. So it seems to us that the logical way to do this, and what, by the way, I'm confident that the Congress intended, was that the states begin to spell this out themselves. That was the discussions we had in Washington when I was there, dealing with the, when the legislative history of this bill came about. This was one of the issues that was intentionally left to the states to develop, and we ought to get it out front in the statute so that at least this minimal definition of compelling reasons. The important thing I want to stress with you is putting it in the executive branch agency's administrative rules is not binding on the court, so it doesn't matter whether what comes down from Washington as suggested regulations for the agencies or what the agency itself determines. The buck stops with me as the judge who has to review whether these compelling reasons exist. So that's our reason for wanting you to consider and adopt the Dash 7 amendments. I'll be glad to answer questions as well.
And as I understand the federal statute, it's clear that states are allowed to define for themselves what the compelling reasons would be. Is that correct?
But the Congress did not do that. And the discussions that we have had, both during the time when that legislation was winging its way through Congress and thereafter with the work group that I served on to do some interpretation that was always the discussion, that this is going to be left to the states and developing case law.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, yeah. It has always been, all of the technical guidance that we have received to date from the federal government has indicated that compelling reasons would be a matter of state law and not federal law. We've had no indications that the unconcrete rule, so to speak, the rule that we finalized, we've had no indications that the federal government is going to make a U-turn and suddenly create straitjacket binding compelling reasons definitions. We've had no indication that this is going to happen. The second thing is, as Ms. Gus said earlier, aggravated circumstances is another concept that the states have been left to define by the federal government. Yet the agency is willing to define aggravated circumstances in the statute, but unwilling to define compelling reasons. Many states, by the way, most states have already made their AFSCA amendments to their statute because they had a legislative session while we were on biennial recess, in the biennium. Many states have, in their statutes, merely repeated the AFSCA language the way that the agency is advocating, but others have deviated markedly from that language. So if there's going to be some kind of U-turn into a straitjacket definition, Oregon will not be the only state that finds themselves, quote-unquote, out of compliance, as the agency fears. And I don't think that the federal government is going to take away all these states' money because the states made a definition and the federal government changed the rules on them in the middle of the stream.
Senator Brown?
I guess from what Judge Harrell just said is that his or the court's discretion is not limited, I assume, by the regulations, but also by statute as I read this. So isn't the reality going to be that we're going to have a set of cases that's going to define what compelling reasons are? And if that's the case, why do we need to even put anything in the amendment?
Well, you won't hear us very often saying you should limit our discretion. What we think is that there's a higher calling here, which is to at least to begin to put some parameters on it. And really only two things here, and it's a pretty simple concept that the parent is working a plan to record reunification, and the agency agrees and the court agrees that that's working as a reason, and the other is there's another better plan, but I don't think we ought to have just totally unbridled discretion, Senator Brown.
Sure, if that's the case, that's the wrong statute, yeah. Then, or the citation is wrong, because 419B.4762D is whether because of special needs or circumstances the child should be placed in the permanent custody.
Oh, Senator Brown, it's actually as that statute, I believe, is amended
by 408.
I would like to tag on to that answer, if I might, Senator Brown, Mr. Chair. Why should we wait for a series of court decisions to define these terms when the legislature could define them now and save everybody the trouble and expense? Don't forget, every time we make a court rule through appellate practice in this area of the law, there is a child sitting in a foster home waiting even longer for a permanent home. So why should we leave this up to the appellate courts to make this decision in policy when the policy-making body for the state of Oregon is rightfully the legislature, not the appellate courts, and not state agencies?
And, Mr. Chair, Senator Brown, that's really the bottom line of our position, that this decision is too important to leave children waiting, and it should be made by this body.
And Rick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Were you finished, Senator Brown?
Yes, I'm
right. I'm concerned about the first compelling reason where the parent is currently working a plan under ORS, blah, blah. I assume that you understand this to mean that it's not just working a plan, but they are really making progress. And what I'm concerned about is that could a parent kind of get into one of these plans and sort of just use it as a... Would this give them legal standing to delay the petition.
Mr. Chair, Senator Burdick, no, we were very careful to put into the bill only pursuant to the rebuttable presumption hearing that was held under 689. And under Senate Bill 689, after a year, a court can only allow a reunification plan to continue if the court finds that specific services for a specific period of time will result in reunification. So it's not a nebulous kind of sort of someday thing. It's specific services for a specific period of time. So they are either working that kind of a specific plan or another plan is available.
Chairman, just to follow up, you can't see a scenario where things just kind of drift along for a year and then all of a sudden the parent signs up for a plan and wants to start the clock running again.
What the court's going to have to determine to get to this point is, I'll give you the usual example that we're going to see. In fact, the example we're going to see a lot, and that is with drug addiction being the present in 75, 80, maybe more percent of the cases that we have. We've got a parent who is really succeeding in drug treatment, and the clock has run out here, and we're within a month or two of treatment, and it looks like it's working. I think everyone envisions that, including SCF, that may very well be a compelling reason in a particular case, and that's why, once again, this is a judicial call. Based on all the facts, ultimately, the buck sort of stops with us. So it's that kind of a thing. I don't think it needs tightening up further for the reasons that Nancy mentioned, but it's certainly, they just entered treatment after a year. No way.
My concern. I'm glad to have that on the record. Thank you.
Yes, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Actually, I have several questions, but the first one is, I have the same concern the Senator just raised, and I think it does need to be tightened up. Otherwise, people are going to have to be running to the legislative record all the time if other judges and other courts. And I just thought about something like the parent is has actively been successfully working a plan or something like that, which tells you the person has actually been following the plan and being somewhat successful at it, because I think right now it's vague. Now, my question is that we've only set forth two absolutes here where you have no discretion. How do you, and there have to be other compelling reasons, and how do you envision deciding those through your discretion, the court's discretion, through a children and family's rulemaking? Have you thought about that?
Well, Representative Riverlot, there is a lot of discretion built into A and B when you think about it. You raised the issue of inserting the word successfully in there, and that occurred to me before you even said it. That is what we mean, and we've not consulted about that, but there is a lot of discretion built in here, particularly Big B, which is another permanent plan is better suited to meet the needs of the child, and so we want to allow for those kinds of things and the application of the court's discretion.
Okay. Further question?
Yes, President.
Well, because you say that such compelling reasons include but are not limited to, there are others outside of A and B. And I was thinking of if you really wanted to have somewhat non-discretionary, you know, we could get into that. It seems to me that there ought to be one there. I'm more concerned about the person who is filing the petition in the first place. We're deciding whether the children and family should join the petition or not join the petition. I think if there is a finding that the person, the outside third-party person who filed the petition, is someone who has been involved in a negative fashion with the child before, that would be a compelling reason. And I would want to, if we're going to do this at all, that would be something that's more important to be almost in the plan.
Yeah, if I may, Representative Ubala, the only the state or the child can file the petition.
Well, here has another party. But when I'm looking at Section 24 on line 7, the first page, it says, for such a petition has been filed by another party, the officer's children join. So you're saying the other party can only be the child
Correct.
Their representative.
Yeah, that's Representative Rubaugh. That language comes from the federal statute.
Okay.
And in Oregon, we limit the filing to children on the state.
Okay.
Representative Lowe.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I apologize. I wasn't able to attend the first part of the hearing, so if I'm asking that question that you've covered the ground on already, please forgive me. But I'm concerned about the amount of time, 15 months and then 22 months, that if we as a policy body go with that length of time, that's a long time for a little child to be sitting there waiting in foster care. And it also gives, but if we do as a policy matter go with that amount of time, it does give a parent quite a long time to already be working on a plan. If they don't have their act together by that point in time, I'm wondering if we should, as a policy matter, extend that amount of time. And the reason why I'm asking this question is I have seen cases, I know of a case in Clackamas County where just exactly that happened. The parent kept trying, went into a plan, went tried to get some drug rehabilitation, fell off the wagon, went back. 4 years that child languished in foster care, or actually did rather well in foster care. That family ended up adopting him. But 4 years is a lot of time for uncertainty for a child, and I'm wondering if there's a policy body we ought to tighten this up. Minnesota has 60 days. Parent has 60 days to get their act together before a child is released. Either Minnesota or Michigan. 15 months is a long time, folks.
Yeah. Currently, the office can terminate the right sooner.
That's right.
If they have the case that will allow them to counsel. Mm-hmm.
Absolutely, Senator Bryant. A termination petition can be filed at any point in the case. And Mr. Chair, Representative Lowe, the 15 of 22 months is the federal standard. And that means, obviously, that a child could go in and out of foster care during that 22
that's
months.
That's the max, right?
Yes. When you reach 15 months, then that's the point at which you have to either flip or fly, so to speak.
But our state can make it shorter if we
wish. It can be made shorter, and the amendments make clear that the permanency hearing, which is the tripping device for changing the permanent plan, can be called at any time by any party, including the judge, without any other party asking for the permanency hearing to be held. The thing, in response to your statement about the children who were in foster care for 4 years, I personally represent children who've been in foster care up to 7 years. It's an ugly situation. People often say sometimes parents get it together after 4 and 5 years, but the important thing to remember is that children are not furniture that you stick into storage and then take out and dust off and they're fine. Children are damaged by long periods of time in foster care. What we should be doing, and it's unfortunate that this bill focuses on termination, because that really shouldn't be the focus at all, but the federal government makes us focus there. What we ought to be doing is we ought to be focusing early on the concurrent planning piece of this legislation, which says we're going to develop a backup plan. And as it becomes apparent that a parent is not going to make it, then we should be working with that parent to implement a concurrent alternative plan that makes it possible for the child to have as much safe contact as possible with their birth parent, but for them to live in a permanent, safe environment that's going to be permanent, that they can call home. That's the ideal. The ideal is not to be terminating parental rights left and right. I used to prosecute termination of parental rights cases. It's kind of fun. You get into it. It's a big trial. But that's not really what's in the best interest of children. What's really in the best interest of children, in the most part, in the most cases, is for them to have as much contact with their birth parents as is safe for them, but for them to live in a permanent, safe environment that they can call home.
Representative Sheridan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I want to welcome Judge Darling.
Yeah.
Who's the mother of my daughter's heartthrob.
I think it's mutual.
He's making shoes six, almost.
The 2 years will be statutory.
You're going to like the next bill with Yale. You want to stay around for the 7:40.
Actually, I'd like a little context on this, if I could. I'm not being very familiar with the procedure here. Looking on line 7, it refers to this plan under ORS 419B4762 sub B, which I understand is as amended by 408. So I look on page 13 of the Handman Gross bill, and sub D doesn't really refer to a plan. It refers to services. If the presumption, and I'll get to that in a second, is rebutted, the court shall order an extension of time certain to specify the services in which the parents are to participate and the progress that is required by the end of the extension. And then that's within my, that piqued my interest. What's the presumption? I see that up on line 18 and or line 17. The parent has not made sufficient progress to allow the child to return safely home. The rebuttable presumption in 419B343-2 is created unless the time period was extended as provided in 419B352. What is this all about?
I can make it fairly simple. Excuse me. Chairman Federley. Huh? Chairman. Bryant, members of the committee, my name is Deanne Darling. I'm a juvenile court judge in Clackamas County. I think I can make it fairly straightforward, and it's directly responsive to what Representative Ubalo was referring to earlier. ORS blah, blah, blah. In many cases, it's easy to look at it and say that. In this case, it is very specific, and it has a specific meaning, and I do this every day. A parent is presumed to be allowed to have 12 months to correct the circumstances to cause the child to be in care. You can move that up, but you cannot move it out unless I find that specific services for a specific period of time will result in reunification. That's the plan that this blah, blah, blah talks about. So what's happened is they've had a hearing, and everybody's said, yes, the agency did exactly what it was supposed to do. The parents are doing what they're supposed to do, but we've run out of our time. 12 months is up. I have to stop and say, fine, go do termination because you didn't make it, or I have to specifically find that more time for a specific service will get the desired result of reunification. And that is the purported compelling reason to say, if we're going to have those hearings and spend all that time to say, you're doing it, the agency's doing it, the family's doing it, and then bam, 3 months later, it's time to terminate because we're at 15 to 22 months, why bother? When I've already had a hearing that said they needed 6, it makes it a nullity. I won't hold those hearings. That's what that's about, is if you've had that and you've said we need 7 months, you don't have to follow the 15-month timeline.
Is the site correct on 2D?
Yes.
Okay.
Which is really Section 8, excuse me, Chairman, Section 18 on page 13 of the Handman Gross bill.
And that's the one that says the presumption is rebutted, the court shall order in the case of time.
That's correct, Chairman.
All right.
This is the language left over from Senate Bill 639.
The key doesn't read very. I think the problem we're having is it doesn't read very well. I think, Judge Darling, and I haven't even done these cases because my recollection is I quit by the time 639 really came into effect. But I guess what folks are concerned about is the parent is currently working a plan. Sounds like somebody who's just gone in for residential treatment. And I'm assuming that the standard you apply to rebut the presumption is a fairly high one. Like a client I had who'd been in residential treatment for 12 months, even though she had a relapse, she found another program within a week, and she was still in the program, and she'd been in the program for the full 12 months. I'm assuming you're looking at folks who have really, you know, 99% been there.
Right, Mr. Chairman, Senator Brown, that's correct. You're looking at people who have been successful but just need a little more time before those kids can go safely home. You're not looking at people that just got started in the 11th month. If we're doing our job right.
Senator Rudy.
And Mr. Chairman, do you think it would make sense to put in here that if someone did invoke this as a compelling reason and you did grant the time, I appreciate your explanation from before that helped clarify it, as the author of the blah, blah, blah comment. Do you feel it would be helpful to put in maybe a provision that only this compelling reason could only be invoked once? Or would that be unnecessary given everything else that you talked about in terms of how hard it would be to get these?
Chairman Senator Burdick, I think at first blush I would say it would be unnecessary, but I don't know what the harm in the end would be. But I think it would be unnecessary. I think it's there already in the context it's put in. Judge Harlan?
I agree with that. And there's a lot of these are training issues for us as judges too, and believe me, we're working very hard at that. I don't think I've ever known the Judicial Department to work harder at that, and especially in this area. And I just can't imagine one of our colleagues giving somebody a second bite at this particular apple. I agree with it would be unnecessary.
Representative Sherman.
No, thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess I'd like to ask the judges if the bill were to specify, as it does, currently working a plan, can you fathom circumstances where your hands would be tied to find compelling circumstances compelling reasons when, in fact, you may want to find otherwise? Say, well, it's there, they're working the plan, I've got to do this, even though my gut tells me it's not the right thing to do. I think that's the thing we'd want to avoid,
right.
Creating that kind of a circumstance in the courtroom where you've got some justification that you know not to proceed further with the plan, but they're participating, and no one has come in and said they're not participating, and so now your hands are tied, I guess. That's the other side of this coin.
Representative Shelley and members of the committee, I don't think so, because the burden of proof shifts, and that's the rebuttable presumption. And it's still, for me, a weighing of the evidence on that basis. So I don't see it. Julian.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Sherrill, members of the committee, I think there's an easier way to get there to avoid that position, and that is once they've had their 12 months, both the agency and the family, to do their jobs, you set a specific period of time, and it can be 3 months, it can be 6 months, it can be 2 months, it can be 1 month, and you said, I'm giving you this amount of time for this specific reason, and the burden is then the parents to do what it is that they've been ordered to do. So you would never be too tied unless you set yourself 24 months in one of those positions, and you'd never do that. So if you wanted not to give anybody more time, you just wouldn't get to this point because you wouldn't extend to 12 months.
To me, what I'm inclined to do, and you can talk me out of this if you want, but I would amend the dash 7s to say, at line 7, a parent is successfully completing a plan. If we're going to put this in statute, it's going to be a state policy. That's really what we're talking about. We want successful completion of the plan. And I think that'll help you in your discretion then, too, because then a parent can't argue, wait a minute, I am currently working on the plan. It doesn't tend to generate an appeal. And so I think it gives you more discretion and a little more of a hammer over that parent.
Some members of the committee, I think that's certainly an acceptable idea. My only suggestion would be successfully working to complete a plan.
Okay.
Because what's the definition of completing?
We just had a little huddle, Mr. Chair. That's good.
Okay. I'll look over at Kay. Does that look all right for you? I know this isn't your amendment, but with that language, you'd be all right? Thank you. All right. Other questions? Thank you, then. We are in work session, and the chair would move amendment to the dash 7 amendments of Senate Bill 408 at line 7 to say the parent is
successfully working to complete.
Yeah, the parent is successfully working to complete a plan, and then the rest of that sentence.
Discussion.
Objection. So order.
Mr. Chair.
Yeah.
I would move the dash 7.
Dash 7.
I move the dash 7 amendments as amended.
Thank you. Senator Brown moves the dash 7 amendments as amended.
Discussion?
Objection? So ordered.
Mr. Chair?
Yeah.
I would move the dash 6 amendments to the bill.
Thank you. Senator Brown moves the dash 6 amendments to Senate Bill 408.
Discussion?
Objection? So ordered. Senator Brown?
I move the bill as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
No, it'll go to Ways and Means.
Oh.
Mr. Chairman of the committee, unless you're going to suspend the rules, we have a rule that says that only bills are in LC form. And
Ah, because of the change in the language.
Correct.
No, we can't do a technical. We'll have to bring it back.
Okay.
All right. We'll bring it back. Give you all a chance to read it one more time. And lobby is perfect.
Sure. I was wondering if the Senate was functioning under some different rules than the over the House. I was pleased to hear.
Depends on how big the crowd is.
Well, it's public hearing on Senate Bill 408. With that, we'll take our leave.
We'll enter our public hearing on now on Senate Bill 740. Representative
Shadley, I just want to note that I hear some grumbling in my committee there. They've been treated shabbily by the committee today, so we are going to be leaving.
Hold on. All our bills are dead on the outside, right?
Starting with the pet probate.
We'll come back anytime.
All right, Mr. Taylor, talk to us about Senate Bill 740.
In our last hearing on this work session on the 1st of April, we adopted the S1-2 and S3 amendments. You may remember that this bill was on the way to the floor, had been passed out by the committee, but the committee decided to send it back for further consideration. Of issues concerning that they are in the dash four amendments, if I could put my hands on them, relating to the age difference between the victim and the perpetrator on consensual sexual acts, would be sexual misconduct and contributing to the sexual delinquency of a minor.
And we have a hand in growth bill. And this turn out to be, a consensus among the committee after Sheriff Tarno pointed to us the fact that without this type of change we're doing on 740, he was going to vote no just because of the potential adolescent comments. Yes. And Senator Courtney's three sons. So, anyway, we have combined the two bills to provide both the requirements of the federal law and what was intended in the other bill. And I want to thank the work group who put this language together for us. I understand they reached consensus. Is that correct, Mr. Chairman?
That's correct, Mr. Chairman of the committee. You'll see what these dash four amendments include, 1, 2, and 3. You'll see the main differences on the dash four on page 4 and on page 5, the bold language and also the statement up on line 2 concerning the applicability.
Right? Yes.
Which two bills are
these? This is on 740.
Right.
And we are talking about the dash four amendments, which should be in your packet. Chairman of the committee.
But you mentioned another.
Oh, the other bill. The other bill was the one that's going to bring 620.
Oh, okay. I'm willing to doubt my bill. Oh, just very briefly, Senator.
Senator Courtney then moves the dash four amendments to Senate Bill 740.
Mr. Chair, if I could be elected, that these would supersede the dash 1, 2, and 3. And include the additional provision.
That's right. This becomes the bill.
Dash four. Okay.
Discussion. Objection.
Senate Bill 740 is amended to the floor to do pass recommendation.
Thank you. Senator Courtney moves Senate Bill 740 to the floor to do pass. Discussion. Objection.
So ordered.
Carrier.
Carrier.
Okay. Senator Court.
I don't want to steal your glory.
Senator Court.
I carried two bills today without the chair. It's very difficult.
Did you miss
me? Yes, I did miss you.
You probably
missed the last Thursday. I took over the meeting and you told me a note that it's going to take over this Tuesday, so that was good, too.
I'll be here for the first 45 minutes for Tuesday.
So you did write to me about next week?
I did.
Well, but you didn't tell me about Thursday.
I did.
No, you didn't.
I did, too.
Oh, sorry, folks. I have a family feud. Excuse me. Forgive me.
Yes, it is.
You never said a word to me. You took all of them. I didn't know where you went. I was there. I had to do the whole thing by myself.
All right, we're going to work session now on Senate Bill 344, and we have a bunch of amendments.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 344 comes to you from the Oregon Youth Authority. We have a whole bunch of amendments. We adopted the Dash 2 amendments the last time. What this bill does, it requires, as amended by the Dash 2 amendments, it requires that in a school, if a person has a gun, it requires the teacher basically to report the person. And then once reported, as applies to both schools and public buildings, it sets forth the procedures that are followed once a juvenile is found to have a gun, what happens through the court proceedings. If I may, we've got a whole series of amendments here. And let me run through them if I could. And
if you could clarify one thing. We've adopted the Dash 2,
that's correct, Mr. Chair.
And the Dash 3?
Not to my knowledge, Mr. Chair.
All right. Or the Dash 4s?
The Dash 4s, no.
Okay, thank you. So only the Dash 2s have been amended.
Sure, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. The Dash 4 amendments are the same as the Dash 2, except they include mandatory reporting for firearms within the previous 90 days. You may remember at the last hearing there was discussion around that issue of mandatory reporting. It's currently drafted and even amended by the Dash 2 amendments. There's no time limit. There was a discussion at the end of the meeting concerning a 90-day time limit as an amendment suggested by Ingrid Swenson of the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. So the previous 90 days and discretionary reporting beyond 90 days. I prepared this amendment based on the discussions at the last meeting. And then the Dash 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, and 10 were put together by Mike Livingston of the Department of Justice. The Dash 5 amendments require school officials to report if the gun was in the school in the last 180 days. The Dash 6 are the same as above, except the cutoff date is 90 days. The Dash 7 amendments limit a police officer's ability to take a youth into custody for possessing a firearm in the public building for within the last 180 days. The Dash 8 are the same as the 7s, except the cutoff period is 90 days. The Dash 9 and 10 you may probably want to consider together. 9 adds the fine for failing to report. So a school official fails to report, they would be subject to a $1,000 fine. The Dash 10 amendments address the issue of liability and basically say anyone who fails to report is immune from liability.
Is immune?
Is immune from liability. What the liability would be the $1,000 violation. I understand the $1,000 violation is in keeping with the reporting requirements under the sex offender statute.
Mike Livingston and Ingrid Swenson, please.
And Mike DeVito, the national.
Okay. We'll do these. I understand.
We want that. From the Department of Justice in conjunction. Mr. Chairman of the committee, if I could add, you may see a bit of this more in the future. I think a lot of these amendments were prepared so the committee would have options to consider, and as you know, that we have to have an amendment, LC form, completed form, before we can adopt it.
And committee, the way we left it last time was that the issue was raised about 6 months after the fact. There was a report that someone brought a gun to school. Under the bill, as presently written, that person then is basically taken into custody and goes through this process. And in fact, it could be even a longer period of time. So, Ms. Swenson suggested 90 days would be a reasonable time, weighing, you know, the risk to the school and others. It looks like Mr. Livingston's come back with an option of 180 days. Is that correct?
The 90-day period and the 180-day were the two periods that we talked about, and so I have the 90 and 180-day options for the reporting cutoff and the 90 and 100-day options for the required custody. Those are two different issues.
Okay.
And the only difference between Dash 6 and the amendment that Mr. Taylor put together is that, which is Dash 4, I believe, is that correct?
That's correct.
Yeah. Is that in Mr. Taylor's amendment, it expressly says that reporting beyond for an offense committed before the 90-day period is discretionary. I think that's implicit in the 4, in the 5 and 6, but that's the only difference.
Committee, if the committee wants to go there, I think it would help to have a statement on the record that the committee consider that implicit too.
Yes, I agree.
Giving that discretion.
Yes, that the reporting is mandatory if the offense is committed within whatever period the committee agrees on, and then but that doesn't mean you can't report it
right.
if it occurs
right.
before that.
Certainly you'd want
yes.
that discretion without telling people that they shouldn't
yes.
report if they feel it's appropriate. Ingrid, did you have any comments?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, no, not in addition. When I proposed an amendment at the last hearing on this matter, I had asked the committee to consider not requiring the reporting of incidents that occurred beyond this 90-day period, but had neglected to talk about the mandatory arrest provision. So I appreciate the fact that that amendment has been prepared, because I think both of those things are important. I think the only reason that you might wish to specify that people may report after the 90-day period or 180-day period, as you decide, would be to make sure that they have immunity if they do, in fact, report beyond that period. If you simply imply that they can, then they may not enjoy the same immunity as people who are required to report.
All right, questions on these amendments? All right, so I understand, and I admit I'm a little foggy at the moment. Mr. Taylor, the dash four amendments?
Correct, Mr. Chairman.
Are the ones that you prepared?
Correct, Mr. Chairman.
And I'm looking at the Hannah Gross.
Chairman of the committee, too, right. We do not have them all engrossed. Some of these amendments are the same as the two. Except they have, for example, in the dash four amendments, have this additional provision of 90 days, plus optional after 90 days. And that depended down the legislative council's office on whether the amendments impacted the original bill or also impacted the dash two amendments. So what we did on the gross version, we only included those that, for example, that were the dash five and six. We did not include four. We did not include amendments that would lend as much to the dash two amendments. They basically should be looked upon as being standalone.
And we have adopted the dash two.
We have adopted the dash two.
All right.
The
pardon? All right. Senator Courtney moves the dash four amendments to Senate Bill 344. Discussion. Objection? So ordered. All right.
Okay. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, if I may, that would obviate consideration of five and six, just to keep things on track.
Okay, and that would leave us with what, Mike?
On the time period, that would leave seven and eight. And what seven and eight speak to are this question that Ingrid raised last time, and that is, should there also be a time limitation for the mandatory custody and detention? And seven puts a 180-day limitation on that, and eight puts a 90-day limitation. In other words, if the officer has probable cause to believe that the youth within the last 180 days has been in possession of a firearm or destructive device, then it becomes a mandatory custody situation, and the alternative, 90 days. It's just a matter of where the committee chooses to cut it off.
And your preference is 180?
Yes.
And those would be the dash seven?
Yes.
All right.
Chair? I move the dash seven amendments.
Thank you. Senator Courtney then moves the dash seven amendments to Senate Bill 344. Discussion?
Sir, I just have a problem, I guess, with the long time. If we're doing 180 days,
The 180 is what the dash sevens do.
I guess with this reporting requirement, I have a somebody out there who's going to do that. I guess he participates in it, then he's absolved from liability. But what if he doesn't participate, then he is. There's always going to be a question of fact out there as to whether he performs his affirmative duty or not. Have a little problem with that.
Your concern then is for the person who, between 90 and 180 days, did not. Maybe heard about a report of a firearm at school and didn't report it?
It's a question of fact. I mean, there's reasonable cause. The fact that somebody tells you, well, you know, you got a bomb in your school. Is that reasonable cause?
Yeah, no, go ahead.
Committee, and Mike and Ingrid can help me on this, but I think we're talking two different sections of the bill. The 90 days is reporting. So if the gun's in the school,
within 90 days, you shall report. If it's 91 days, you may report. The issue we're talking here is on page 2 of the bill, and that talks about probable cause to take a person into custody. And that would basically say, if I'm correct, that it would be 180 days that have probable cause. So there's a police officer. Mike, could you walk, give us a factual scenario here?
Well, the officer may have this information independent of what the school does or doesn't report, or it may be a discretionary report from the school outside of the 90-day period.
Mm-hmm.
But if the event occurred within 180 days, the officer can go ahead and place the youth into custody, and then the court hearing will determine whether the youth is released. That's the difference.
Mr. Chair, could I comment?
Yes.
I know Mr. Livingston has expressed a preference for the 180-day period. However, for a couple of reasons, I think the 90-day period is probably more appropriate. First of all, it's consistent with the reporting requirement. But secondly, police officers already do have the ability to take into custody the people who represent a danger for whom they have probable cause to believe that a violation of one of these statutes has occurred. And the only question here is, must they do so? If that possession has occurred within the last 90 days, there's an argument that can be made that this person represents a present danger warranting the detention in custody of that person. If more than 90 days has passed, and presumably this event has ended more than 90 days previously, the officer has discretion to make that arrest, but need not do so. So I would urge the committee to consider limiting that to the 90-day period rather than 180 days.
Yes, Senator.
I think we also need to keep in mind the nature of the school year, which is that you have a 90-day period between school years. So if somebody were to have a firearm in the school, say, at the end of May, and that is when Thurston occurred, then the summer passes by, and then you find out about it first thing in the fall. I want to account for summer. Have we lost our chance to reevaluate the 90-day versus 180-day for the reporting for that same reason? Does dash 4 mean that we've accepted 90 days?
It does, but you can still report. It's just, as I understand it, the mandatory requirement to report.
Well, back to that.
We can go back and revisit that, too. We're having a discussion on a motion, but the bill is still before us.
I guess that's my concern, is that I think we need to account for that kind of dead period in our discussion of this, because you could have a situation at the end of the school year, and it would be very relevant to report it and to deal with it if you heard about it first thing in the fall, and yet you'd be beyond the 90-day period.
Kim? Which would be the dash 5 amendments, is that correct?
Mr. Chairman of the committee, that's correct.
Okay. I'm going to go back to Senator Nelson. Dave, your earlier question dealt more with the question of immunity than...
Yeah, I'm trying to report it, I guess, is my issue. It's different than the problem.
Excuse me, Senator? Yes. In regard to that, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, at 90 days of mandatory reporting, after that, it's discretionary. There's no duty to do so. So the issue could arise at 90 days. If it is extended to 180 days of the chair members of the committee, that would be a duty. That would increase the potential for possible liability. Now, I can tell you that I talked to Dave Hendricks from Legislative Counsel's office about this issue of liability, and I understand there's a lawsuit currently against a lawyer who represented someone concerning the reporting of child abuse. We're not sure what the status of that case is, but I heard of it and you heard of it also. And the courts are going, leaning more towards that there's a statutory duty, and to breach that duty, they are leaning towards finding liability.
Mr. Chairman of the committee, if I can add to what Ms. Swenson called discretion on the part of the officer, if you adopt the 90-day period for custody,
the officer really does not have discretion to take the youth into custody if the offense occurred outside that period. Under current law, if we cut this off at 90 days, the officer is required to release the youth unless the officer can make a determination that the youth immediately is an immediate danger. So, I mean, discretion to me means the officer can make it, the call either way and still be authorized to do so. What the law says is it must be returned to the guardian or the parent unless the officer has probable cause to believe that the welfare of the youth or others are immediately in danger. And I think one of the concepts in this bill is sometimes not only should the court decide, but sometimes the court is going to have a mental health assessment or screening in order to make that decision. And so I think, you know, whatever time period you choose, that's going to be the cutoff for the ability to require the custody. Otherwise, it'd be the presumption is that the youth is returned to the parent. So it's really not discretion.
Well, and if I could comment, Mr. Chair, what it is discretion to be exercised only if there's a danger. But what this measure would do is say, danger or no, if it's within this time period, you must take them into custody. So it certainly is discretionary. You don't have to take them into custody. If you find that they are dangerous, then you may, after the time period, if you adopt this amendment.
Right. I think what Mike's saying, though, is more difficult to establish that criteria, that limit, that barrier to make them dangerous. Less likely to do that, maybe fearing false arrest or something along those lines.
Mr. Chair, again, presumably we're talking about people who you want to retain in custody because there's some major concern about their representing a risk to themselves or someone else. And unless there's some indicia that there's conduct or statements or other involvement with law enforcement authorities that raises that issue, indeed, then it is just an ordinary case of possession of a weapon that never represented the kind of danger that this bill seeks to address.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, it seems to me that that's really the core of the bill, is that the legislature is making a determination that people of this age who possess these types of objects in school do want immediate attention.
What I think I would like to do is go to the 180 days. And I might be erring on the side of public safety, but right now in the situation that Oregon has had, I'd rather head in that direction than shorten the time frame. And that was different than what I said earlier. But with that in mind, I would, once we're done with this particular motion, which is 180 days on one point, go back to the dash 5 and adopt 180 days as far as the man. All right. Yes, everybody?
Has anyone ever thought about 120 days? That would take into account the scenario I was concerned about, which was I don't know, it's just a thought.
All right, so Carmen, how do you feel about 120 days?
I guess I just have a philosophy of why you're putting this field out and making this mandatory reporting requirement to maybe driving people in.
I think there has to be some cutoff, and if we can set that time frame whenever we want. Right now it's somewhere between 90 and 100. But Senator Burdick's point I think is well taken, that if it happened at the end of the school year wasn't reported until the following September, you might want some additional time to require a mandatory reporting. Well, no, no. The first time frame, it's mandatory. If you know, you've got to report it. Unless you reasonably believe that it occurred, you need to report it.
It happens, and you could report it.
You could report it, but that would be discretionary.
I'm a child going on 120 years old. I prefer my I have a hard time.
Okay. Any else?
I guess I still have some difficulty. I may have deserved my right to change my vote.
All right. Well, that is certainly true. Senator Courtney?
We're going to kill the motion on 180.
I'm going to ask you to withdraw your motion on the dash 7.
I withdraw the motion.
Thank you. Thank you. And Mr. Taylor? We are going to then amend the dash 5 and the dash 7 to say 120.
Mr. Chair, you said you're going to suspend the rules?
No. Can I do that?
Is
it just a few days?
Are we getting recorded? Are they listening to me downstairs? Well, we could do it and find out afterwards. I mean, I'll bring it back if they have to. But.
Okay, why don't we do that? Is it a little risque to change it from 30 days from the...
Mr. Chairman, as a committee, I'm going to have to have these amendments combined into one amendment anyway, so I am going to have to go to the Legislative Council's office. If for some reason this causes a serious problem, then...
Bring it back. We'll do it this week.
Do it Wednesday.
Yeah, we'll do it Wednesday. About 120 days.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, there is one other subject that the remaining amendments address, and it was an issue that was raised by Senator Nelson in the last work session, and that is the potential liability versus immunity for the person who fails to make the mandatory report. And I drafted in the dash 10s a provision, if the committee wants to consider it, of creating immunity from civil liability for failure to report under the required, whether it's 180 or 120 or 90. Along with that, I've also drafted a dash 9, which, as Mr. Taylor suggested, might be considered with the immunity from civil suit, which makes the violation of the reporting requirement a $1,000 fine, which reflects the penalty for failing to report child abuse. Jim Green and Tricia Smith have some comments about that proposal if the committee wishes to take it up to the effect that there are, if you will, sticks to require the reporting, even if there also is immunity from civil suit. And I have these here not because the proponents of the bill are particularly pushing this one way or another, but I realize it was a point that Senator Nelson raised last work session.
I would say my preference would be to adopt the dash 10s if we're going to adopt them rather than the dash 9s. There already are requirements on school personnel, including teachers through their certification, about I think what they need to do. Wouldn't they be subject to the Teacher Standards and Practices Act?
My understanding is that they can be that discipline with respect to licensure for violation of any state law, and also there is an internal reporting requirement that the school boards have in the districts.
I'd say their job would be in jeopardy too, even if they weren't certified. Right. So, yes.
So, Mr. Chairman, what this does in effect is we adopt the dash 10s and not the dash 9s. We're taking away the possibility of civil liability, and we're not providing any criminal liability beyond the licensing requirements that they have.
What it does is, if the person reporting has reasonable grounds for making the report, there's a grant of immunity from liability, civil or criminal, for doing that. What that would mean is if you reported that Johnny took a gun to school and it turned out that was false, if you didn't have reasonable grounds, you could still be sued civilly, or you could possibly go through a criminal investigation and, indictment for making a false police report.
Yeah.
But if you have reasonable grounds for believing that Johnny brought that gun to school, then there'd be immunity.
But what I understood him saying, what I see on line 12 here right. of the Dash 10 Amendments, is if you fail to report, then you have liability, then you have immunity. If you don't do your duty under this bill, that's how I read this.
That's correct.
And I'm wrong.
Mr. Chair, Senator Burdick, that's correct. Lines 6 through 11 really were in the previous bill. I think they're in the Dash 2s, which cover the situation Senator Bryant mentioned. Lines 12 through 14 address the issue raised by Senator Nelson, which is the failure to report.
Okay. I hadn't gotten that far. Senator Courtney, you had a comment on...
Is the bill coming back?
It'll have to, with 120 days.
I'm going.
I'll come back Wednesday. Yes, Senator Burdick.
I'm really comfortable with the immunity for the people who report, but I'm not comfortable with the...
Immunity for those that don't. Okay. So we have two that way. Senator Nelson?
Well, again, that's maybe it's a willful. Maybe we're talking about a willful failure to report versus just somebody who maybe has some information and does not report, and all of a sudden they're involved in this thing. You get a fellow who's maybe not even a teacher, who's maybe watching the windows or doing something as a public employee. And just me, it just seems like it spreads things out so much that...
If that person, the window washer, did report, then there'd be this limited immunity if he or she had reasonable grounds. So, but which I think we're in consensus we want to report. What the 10s do, though, is take it a step further and say if he doesn't report or she doesn't report, then they can't be sued even if they should have.
I'm all right with that.
Okay.
I don't
think we need them.
So
we don't need the 9 or the 10.
No, but we need an amendment that speaks to liability.
I think we have that already. It's already in the bill.
What's in the bill is no civil or criminal liability if you participate in the making of the report. There's nothing that addresses the failure to make a report, either the mandatory or the discretionary report.
So there's already immunity if you have reasonable grounds to make the report,
right?
Which is, I think, what you wanted.
Right,
sure was in the bill.
But Mr. Chairman,
yep.
The Dash 9 amendments in lines 12 through 16 impose a penalty for not reporting. So.
Right, and I wasn't going to do the Dash 9s either. No. Because I think there's other things that can happen if you're an employee and don't report.
And the immunity from liability for participating in the report is a situation where you make the report, turns out that it was incorrect, and then otherwise you would be sued for malicious prosecution or false arrest or something like that. You'd be immune from that.
I'm very interested in, because there's so much pressure in some of these circumstances not to report, okay. I'm very interested in enforcing the reporting requirement, and that's what appealed to me about the Dash 9.
I understand. Don't think you have enough to pass the Dash 9.
I gather that, Mr. Chairman. I can count.
All right. So we have, let me summarize if I could. We've adopted the Dash 2s. We've adopted the Dash 4s. And we're going to bring back 120 days in a new amendment to the Dash 11s.
Just for the record, there hasn't been a consensus on this bill. It's quite obvious to me. How bad is that going to be in the High Council in terms of people going crazy?
Mr. Chairman of the committee, this is the year we go, time of year we go crazy anyway, so don't worry about that. The only thing I'd like would be some clarification. We're talking about 120 days, and the Dash 4 amendments, we said 90 days mandatory, and we explicitly state discretionary after that. Do you want to stick with that language, which would be 120 days mandatory discretionary after that, or do you simply want to go with the Dash 5 amendments changing it to 120 days? I'm just looking for point of clarification.
I believe it was 120 days and discretionary after that.
Okay. So I go to the dash four amendments and change 90 to 120. Okay, Mr. Chair. Mr. Mayor.
Other comments or directions? All right. Thank you for your patience. And we'll then close the public hearing on Senate Bill 344. And
Mr. Chairman,
right. We'll open the session on Senate Bill 848.
Chair members of the committee, you may remember this bill from the other day, and this would make it a Class A misdemeanor to point a laser light in the direction of a police officer. Mr. Cross is here, and I believe he also has a witness who has a laser-sighted weapon, if you're interested in seeing it.
Mr. Cross.
Mr. Chair, committee members, for the record, my name is Bill Cross. I'm here on behalf of the Oregon State Police Officers Association, and with me today is Sergeant Curtis, and I just wanted to give the committee an opportunity to see the issue that we're concerned about with regard to lasers and the potential for an officer to mistake a laser for a weapon and consequently the need for some legislation.
Sure, Brian, members of the committee. My name is Curtis Curtis. I'm a sergeant with the Patrol Services Division of the Oregon State Police. Here to basically give a demonstration, if I may. It does involve the use of a weapon. I'm going to make the mistake of telling you it's been rendered safe, but we've taken all the security precautions that we can to show that the weapon is hard to fire at this time. The magazine's missing, it slides open, and it's got several pieces of nylon through it. The issue that we have at this point in time is that the beam that's put out by a laser-sighted weapon, and these devices are available on the open market. This belongs to a gentleman that I consider a friend who also works in security. He purchased the full package for $900 here locally. I called two gun dealers here in the Salem area, did not identify myself. She said that I had a Glock 40 caliber handgun, and I wanted to put a laser sight on it for target practice. They both assured me that it could be done for under $600 up in the Portland area without asking any type of questions as to why I wanted it other than that. The laser sight, I'm going to go off the side here. As soon as it's pointed, that targets where that bullet's going to go. You don't have to look at what you're doing other than the fact, okay, boom. As soon as that dot is on its target, you have a target acquisition. These were devices that were developed by the military. They're used by SWAT teams in high-stress situations. As you enter a room, you scan. The minute the dot hits your target, that's your target. You don't have to take time to go in and sight. So basically, anybody can have a weapon like this with a sighting device like this. As soon as they have the red dot on the target they want to shoot at, we have a basic problem. Laser pointing device. Under $20 here locally, Office Depot. You notice the barrel on it. In a darkened situation, would this be a gun? If I were pointing it from a distance, what do I have? But if you look at the red dot, very similar. Both devices will go several hundred feet and show a bright dot on the target or whatever you're pointing it at. These are the concerns that we have. Another laser device, under $20, similar dot, similar patterns. So these are the concerns that we do have with this because being a defensive tactics instructor for the agency for 20 years, I find it a situation, do I tell my people hesitate when there's a possibility that a weapon's being pointed at them? Do they seek cover? Do they dive? Do they look? Where do they go? When they're driving along and have something that shows up as a red dot on them or the dash of their car, do they take evasive action? They start looking around for a laser light. And as these things become more and more common, these things are becoming more and more common also.
Yes, Senator Curtis.
So where can you buy these?
I contacted Anderson's, and I think it was the other one was Weatherby Guns Shop here in Salem. Both places locally just gave a phone call and said, I've got a weapon that I would like to have a laser sight put on. There's an outfit up in Portland that will do it for $600. So I put some on.
I was asked no further information about why I wanted it, anything like that, other than said I wanted it for target practice.
The miners buy them?
I'm not familiar with that. I didn't inquire into that, sir.
Well, see, I'll go along with the bill, but I can think of all kinds of scenarios. A bus driver might find that. I don't know, somebody fooling around out where airplanes are. You could have all kinds of messes on your hand existing. So while we're going to do this for free, I'm just going to tell you, probably it's going to come back to us in some way or other. I'm just going to tell you that right here now. So, I mean,
really, even with someone else wanting the same protection?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I can see somebody, because the police officer, he's particularly sensitive because he's chairing them all, but you get, you know, we've had situations in our society where, you know, it has. They go crazy. And so I have a feeling that we're going to take a very short-sighted view right now. We're going to do this for the police officers. The truth of the matter is we ought to use a much more comprehensive approach to these things than we are. And so I'll send the bill out, but I just think, Mr. Chair, it's going to come back and haunt us about areas.
I agree with this Senator. I'd like to add, though, that with the law enforcement community that may shoot spontaneously to that red dot being placed on their chest, whereas all of other folks may not. And that puts them into a tremendous guilt area, if you will, if it's kids just playing a prank. Because these guys, the law enforcement guys, are armed. And I know if I were in a patrol car and I see a red dot on my chest, I'm going to take evasive action. Even the point of drawing that firearm to the potential reality of defending myself.
I bet you've got this chair to do the dialogue. You've got people, and like a bus driver taking evasive action, you've got people with concealed weapons permits that are on, they have weapons on them. I mean, you know, you could have all kinds of situations where this thing could create a real disaster beyond a uniformed officer. That's all I'm saying to you. We are looking, not to believe the place is an iceberg, but if they're reacting that way to it, don't think there are some other people in certain walks of life that might react the same way. And maybe they don't shoot, but they take evasive action and end up in a major accident somewhere.
Well, I did get a letter from someone representing security guards. And I told them to contact you since it's your bill. But they were going to ask to have an amendment made so that it would also cover uniformed security guards, because apparently they had a situation where it happened also. But I think we should move the bill today if it comes back different from the House, including more situations with people. I have no objection to that. There was one potential amendment that's here. We do not have to adopt it, but it just was a discussion of should it be a Class A misdemeanor or a Class C. Class A misdemeanor is, what's the penalty there?
Right, Mr. Chair, I think as Senator Tarnow pointed out the last time, the big difference is as a Class A, it's easier for the police officer can conduct a search. As a C, he cannot.
So we'll leave it as an A.
Yes.
All right, we'll leave it as an A then. And so Senator Tarnow then moves that the Senate Bill 848 go to the floor, do pass recommendation, discussion, objection, order. And Bill, I have the letter from who wrote to me on the security person. Ingrid, you went like this. Sure. We'll continue the work session.
Thank you very much. I'm sorry for language. Ingrid Smith, Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. Police can search on a Class A, B, or C misdemeanor. They can't search pursuant to a arrest on a citation on a violation. The difference between the classes of misdemeanors is that the offense has to occur in their presence in order for them to arrest. If they have probable cause and it doesn't occur in their presence on a B or C misdemeanor, they have to get a citizen's complaint form prepared. So a Class C misdemeanor would authorize the police to arrest and search pursuant to that arrest.
I change your mind at all?
No.
For exception, Senator Tarnow will carry that bill. We have one final bill.
Thank you.
House Bill 2204 will have a work session and hear our results. Oh, yeah, this isn't we'll do a hearing. Why not? Hear notes today.
I thought you were abandoning the rules.
Uh-huh. No, we'd never do that. You gotta have rules.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, my name is Karen Brazil. I'm the Deputy Director for the Oregon Youth Authority. My written testimony is coming around in comparison with other things you've heard today. This is, I hope, pretty straightforward. We are asking to amend statute to make it clear that the Youth Authority has the ability to collect parental support from juveniles who are convicted in adult court but housed with the Oregon Youth Authority. And we're doing this at the advice of the Attorney General's office. I have more information if you want it. Or
I'm pretty convinced. What about the rest of the committee? Any questions? Thank you. We'll close the public hearing and open the work session on House Bill 2204.
This is the House Bill 2204 is for the good pass recommendation, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Senator Courtney moves House Bill 2204. The floor has passed. Discussion? Objections to the work? Committee, we're adjourned. Thank you for your hard work, Stephanie. What? Oh, you know, and I agree. And when the other...